On No King's Day on June 14th, there were a lot of American flags present at many of the demonstrations. That's not something you often see at protests attended by progressive activists. But author Paul Loeb, in his book The Fulcrum, writes about why it's important for protesters to reclaim the flag. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Loeb about his views on a symbol that's often associated with the political right.
You're advocating a different approach to some of these protests, or maybe all of the protests, and you're talking about the use of the flag. And I know that some people have cynically suggested that the way to achieve success in American politics is to wrap yourself in the flag.
Right.
But the way they mean it is kind of like, you know, don't take it seriously, but just, you know, that's just a way to get votes. But you're kind of saying something else.
One of the things that I've been thinking about is that if I go back 100 years ago, 120 years ago, and I look, say, at the American labor movement, there are always flags. I mean, they were marching, and you know, even like the most radical sectors of it, like the Wobblies, the IWW. I mean, you look at their photo, something like the sort of Lawrence textile strike it was called the Bread and Roses strike, because it was like, we don't want to just survive, we actually want to have decent lives. And there's a photo of them like confronting troops with bayonets with the flags at the front. And then if you look more recently, the last 20 years, last 30 years, last 40 years, at particularly progressive demonstrations, they tend not to have the flag. And the flag has, mentioned being people wrapping themselves, and it's sort of been assumed that the flag is a sort of symbol of the political right. And they certainly fly it all the time on, you know, American flags next to a Trump flag. And it strikes me that, I mean, this is true, I would say, in general, but particularly in our current moment where democracy, for all its flaws, is now seriously just challenged and under attack, that being able to make clear that the flag belongs to all of us, represents the best of our democratic traditions as well as the abuses. And I think that's a really important thing to do. And so, you know, it happens that the No Flags Days, the No King's Day demonstrations are, because it happens to be Flag Day on the 14th, that those are specifically encouraging people to bring flags. But to me, it's also really important. And it's not to say that the flags replace all other kinds of signs or posters or any of that, because to me, they amplify it. And then the posters give it, or the signs give it, very specific content. This is what we are challenging. This is what we are standing for. But the flag says, and all of this that we're marching for or rallying for has to do with, at least certainly in these times, with defending democracy, and that this flag is ours as well.
And I guess you're talking also about how it would play to the broader public if you, for example, burn a flag as opposed to carry a flag and say we're proud to be Americans. So it's a little tricky there, I guess, because if you burn a flag, in a way, you're expressing your right to free expression.
Right. And I mean, there hasn't been that much flag burning lately, but there certainly is during the Vietnam era, there were some, and, you know, and never since. And to me, what it does is the message. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it sounds like I am just so disgusted with the flag and that, you know, that I'm going to burn it. But if somebody's watching it and they revered and say they fought in a war or something like that, hits them really personally. And they take it as an affront. And so if you look at the way that the right-wing media sort of recycled the relatively few images that there are burning the flags, they make them omnipresent. And it's like, these people are outsiders, they hate America, on and on and on. And I think to me, the part of the challenge is, if you're coming from the progressive tradition, which probably a majority of the station's listeners are, not all, but, you know, you're thinking, well, here's America that's done these bad things in the world. And, you know, no question about that. And you can name lots and lots of wars. And I've certainly marched in demonstrations against most of them. And it certainly continues on. And so those are the reasons, I suppose you could call them legitimate reasons for estrangement. But to me, to say, hey, we are part of this country, we are as legitimate as anybody defending these particular actions, it makes for a stronger case. And it makes for, I mean, the reality is, if we're going to stop the Trump administration's assaults on democracy, those are going to be only stopped with an enormously broad coalition of folks. And it's going to take progressives, and it's going to take conservatives, and it's going to take independents, and it's going to take people from just a wide variety of backgrounds, because that's what it takes to challenge a regime that's basically, from my view, you know, set on destroying all dissent. You have to have a broad coalition, because otherwise they marginalize each other. And sometimes we do get self-marginalized. I mean, this is not exactly the same thing, but it's about marginalization of movements. Is years ago, when was it, 1972, I got kicked out of Stanford University for anti-war activity. And the interesting thing is they kicked out about 100 people that year. They just sort of like, hey, let's just target the leaders and throw them out. Faculty, students, I was a student. And
so they kicked you out for a peaceful protest?
They kicked us out for, I mean, I think we were, in my case, we were in a room with military recruiters, or not really, it was Honeywell Corporation that was manufacturing the cluster bombs. And they were doing job recruiting, and we had pictures of what the cluster bombs did and showed them, and would you leave? No, we won't leave. And so that was, you know, but it was part of larger campaigns. A few years before, I think two or three years before, there'd been a massive sit-in at a military research center that was connected with Stanford. And basically, when they tried to kick people out for that, the faculty ended up supporting the people who were being kicked out. But by the time we came around, basically, it was very split. It wasn't like the sentiment was, how to describe it? It was more anti-war throughout the campus than it had been several years earlier. But there were just all sorts of people who were doing things like trashing windows of bookstores and the library and whatnot. And the people in the movement, it tarred the entire movement. And people basically were just like, you know, these people are crazy. We don't like them. And so I think part of what's happened,
kind of like the Black Bloc people, in
very much like the Black Bloc, exactly, very much like the Black Bloc people. And so what it, you know, and I saw, you know, again, Stanford's kind of an atypical case, but this was just my personal experience, is that had we done the exact same things 3 years earlier, we wouldn't have gotten kicked out. And I think what happens is, you know, and this is, again, there is an impulse. I mean, this goes beyond the flags to the question of violence, property damages and demonstrations, stuff like that. But there's an impulse of anger. Something's happening. It's really bad. You want to resist. You want to strike back in the way, you know, that you feel like is the strongest way. And so you smash a window or a car or whatever happens to be. But what that actually ends up doing, and there's all sorts of research where people have looked at violent movements versus nonviolent movements, or, you know, or even movements that are sort of, maybe that's not violence against people, but the symbols of destruction of property are the ones that get broadcasts that strengthen the hand of the regime. And the ones that are nonviolent are just simply a lot more successful. And I think the reason is, and it's similar to the flag, is that they're harder to marginalize. I mean, if you look at the rhetoric of Trump around Los Angeles, you know, there are a very small percentage of the people who are demonstrating burned, you know, like Waymo cars and smashing windows and those images. But those images get repeated on and over and over and over again. And, you know, if you watch Fox or something like that, those are the dominant images.
Even if you hear the reporters, even the TV reporters will sometimes say it was a mostly peaceful demonstration.
Right.
That, you're saying that in a way doesn't matter.
Right. That it was, well, it does matter, because it's better than the TV reporters saying it's not a peaceful demonstration. So it does matter. But what it says is that the tendency of the political right and the tendency of authoritarians in general is to basically present this, here's this insurrection, Los Angeles is burning, and so we have no choice but to federalize
Trump,
the National
Guard.
Trump
was saying the whole city would burn if he hadn't intervened.
Yeah. The whole city would burn if it hadn't intervened. Yeah. And the whole city, you know, you mentioned Portland, you know, they, you know, back in 2020, the whole city was burning. And we have friends in Portland. And it's like, yeah, I'm fine in my neighborhood. Yeah, there's the Black Bloc crazies down, you know, on a couple of blocks downtown. And so I think part of the challenge, and again, it's not the same issue, but it's related, which is you want to present the demonstrations as basically saying, what is the issue to talk about? The issue to talk about is, in this, in our current situation, is, are the assaults on democracy? Well, and lots of other issues like that. Big, what do they call it? Big bad bill going through the Senate to gut Medicaid with, not throw 10 million people off Medicaid and Medicare. I mean, a lot of issues. But you want people focused on that issue, as opposed to, there are these crazies smashing a window, burning a car, or burning the flag. And then again, with the flag, I think, it's not like it's a magic salve that will just sort of, okay, this solves everything. Suddenly Fox will say, oh, we've seen the light, they're carrying flags, they must be nice people. I'm not naive about that. But what it does is that it basically, somebody's watching it, somebody who's not necessarily politically engaged, somebody who's more conservative, but they're not, they don't want an end to democracy. So they're winnable potentially. And they're looking at that and they're like, okay, these folks are carrying a symbol that I resonate to as well. They embrace that symbol. And I might look at that sign that now that's being carried right next to that symbol. And I think that that's it, it's getting that message out and not marginalizing themselves. To me, that just seems, it seems really important. And again, the flags and I have to basically confess that, like, I guess maybe the last 10 or 15 years when there's a demonstration and people are carrying flags, they're like, good idea. They've got a flag. That's great. That makes the rest of our signs more powerful. And then, like, but would I carry a flag? Well, no, I'll just carry a sign. And then it was just like, okay, this is no King's Day. It's Flag Day. And I, like, literally, well, where do you buy a flag anyway? I'm serious. Like, I went online. I was like, okay, how do you buy a flag? Well, I'm not going to buy it from Amazon because I hate Amazon. I know you can buy anything there. But then I was like, oh, my local hardware store has flags. I didn't notice that. Must be on an aisle I don't go to that often. Yeah. So I go to my hardware store and, I write up in this piece that's on commondreams.org the other day. And, the woman is sort of, I can tell that is a young woman, African-American woman in this case. And I'm older, an older white guy. And she's kind of, it's like, is this a Trump person buying a flag?
Yeah.
Like rubbing our face or something like that. And I said, well, actually, I'm buying it for, she doesn't say anything. I mean, it's, you can't. It's your, her job's not to like talk politics with customers. But I say, oh, I'm buying it for the No King's Day demonstrations against Trump. She gets this big grin on her face. And I think, part of it is, again, the reflex action may be, okay, well, that's not me. I'm not going to care. But I actually think, though, that it, again, it doesn't replace all the other signs. It doesn't replace everything else that's said. But what it does is it says what we are fighting for, and especially now, is this, again, flawed, we know that, but it's a democracy. And compared to the kind of world where the Trump folks want to take us, which would not be a democracy, which would be like, Putin or Orban's Hungary or Turkey. I mean, there's lots of examples, unfortunately, these days.
But for people who, say, on the socialist left, who want to uproot the capitalist system, do you get the sense that they would feel like, oh my God, I'm carrying the flag of imperialism and I can't do it, that kind of thing?
Well, I think, again, this is why it was interesting to me looking at the Wobblies and, the marches of the labor radicals of the 30s, is they're carrying flags. So, there's two separate questions. One is it better to have a democracy or not? And two, well, what kind of economic system do you want? And what do you do with the economic system you have? And are there ways to improve it and, or replace it? But if you lose the ability to have a democracy, then the only possibility of how do you make change? I mean, unless you actually believe that somehow, a small groups of people could take on the U.S. Army, I mean, it's just like fantasy land. So to me, the question of empires, it's tricky. I mean, one of my people don't read them much these days, but there was a historian named Appleman Williams,
yeah,
who is one of my heroes. And interesting heritage, because he came out of Kansas, went to the Naval Academy, commanded, I think it was a landing ship in World War II, and then wrote a series of books that during the Vietnam era were the most influential books on young historians challenging that war, and challenging not just that war, but his sort of culminating book was called Empire as a Way of Life. And it was about the ways that basically America has historically taken things that are not theirs. And he's very strong about it. One of the things that he says is the people who, you know, there's also a countercurrent that challenged empire and includes all sorts of people from all sorts of perspectives. So it includes, you know, radicals and radical socialists, and it includes mainstream Democrats, and includes some Republicans. And it's just, it's a wide variety of folks. And all, in his view, all of them deserved honor for challenging empire. And, you know, at some points they succeeded. And at some points they didn't succeed. And so even if you believe that the U.S. has elements of an empire, which, you know, if you're going to look historically, it certainly has had a fair amount of them, and that some of our actions, you know, Williams died, oh, I can't remember, probably 20 years ago, you know, the action period since continued to do so, you still want to say this flag, it's contested territory. This country's democracy is contested. You can support empire, which we don't like, or you can support an equitable relationship to the world and a democracy at home. And
yeah, there's always been that tension between those who wanted a democratic republic and those who wanted an expansionist empire. And
yeah,
it seems like the forces of empire have usually won out.
Well, they have, you know, sometimes, you know, and there are lots of, you know, Mark Twain, one of America's heroes, was a strong opponent of empire. And, you know, there are
Abe
a lot
Lincoln,
of forces.
Yeah.
Abe Lincoln, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, in a way, carrying the flag is to me saying, you know, if we're going to go back that far, yeah, I stand with Abe Lincoln. I stand with Mark Twain. I stand with the people. I mean, I'm not a pacifist. So to me, World War II was like, okay, you've got Hitler. You have to stop him. And so you are willing to sacrifice your life for it. And I think that that's important. It's also interesting that, you know, if I look internationally in movements that succeed, I mean, it was interesting. I took this spring in April, I went to Vietnam where I'd never been before. And I got my political start, as mentioned, in protesting that war. So it was interesting to me to go there and, you know, look at how they viewed the war and look at everything that's happened since. And one of the things that was very interesting to me and very unexpected was that when I was going, you know, sort of traveling, I was with a tour group and we went to shrines and looked at the statues and walked around the cities and all that, is that there are these sort of statues or shrines to kings during the 13th, 15th, 12th century who had fought off the Mongols, the Chinese, the Mongols again, the Chinese again. I mean, Vietnam is a country it's been invaded a lot by a lot of other countries. And what I call the Vietnam War and what you probably call the Vietnam War, they call the American War, because before the American War, there was the French War and there was the Japanese War and there was multiple Chinese wars. And what was interesting to me is here you are in this, I mean, in complicated country, because it's got its economy which has done really well as a market economy, but calls itself a communist country. And you would sort of think that the kings would just be like, hey, this is feudalism. This is not, you know, this doesn't mesh with our supposed vision for the country. But what was interesting is that it was just completely seamlessly, you know, you have a statue of a king on Dien Bien Phu Street. And what I realized when I was talking with different folks about it, it was just like they saw it as a narrative of fighting for national independence. And one of the things that was interesting, and I remember that during the war, when I was an anti-war activist, is just that we often ended up forgetting this point, but at least at the beginning, we kept pointing out that this is a nationalist fight against an external country invading them. And it's
even
really
Robert
hard.
McNamara admitted that later on.
And even McNamara admitted it later on. And that was why it was so hard for this huge superpower, the U.S., and not hard, why they didn't defeat the Vietnamese, is because they were fighting, you know, and they were fighting for their country and not just for a particular ideology of Ho Chi Minh and communism and what. And so that's the feeling of you are defending the basis of your country, that runs really deep. I mean, it's the same way in, you know, earlier this year with South Korea, there were flags on both sides because they're protests to keep that you and the president who got impeached. and they're both carrying flags because the flag was the symbol of the country. And so I think it just, to me, it's, again, I mean, you know, if I look at successful and unsuccessful movements, the successful ones embrace this sense of we're part of this national heritage. And again, a lot of us who've, you know, marched for Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, I mean, lots and lots and lots of Central America wars. And, you know, it does feel like, oh, I don't want to carry the flag of empire. But again, it's not just the flag of empire. It's a flag that represents, I think, everything that the U.S. is, which is this very complicated country with a lot of contested strains between different visions of where it's going to go.
Paul Loeb writes books on social change. In addition to The Fulcrum, he's written Soul of a Citizen and The Impossible Will Take a Little While. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on June 16th, 2025.